G'day, we're Atlassian, the makers behind popular teamwork software like Jira, Trello, and Confluence. Whether it's real-time collaboration or staying aligned on key goals, Atlassian's agile work management solutions empower dev, business, and IT teams across the whole enterprise to work more efficiently together. It's exactly why 83% of the Fortune 500 trust Atlassian every day to stay agile and move work forward. See what Atlassian can do for your teams at atlassian.com.
What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away? Or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play? Or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? To find your MO, tap now. Or for information on safe travel, come see me at visitmo.com.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Jess Hilarious, host of Carefully Reckless on the Black Effect Podcast Network. I'm about tired of having to come on here and tell y'all the same thing now. I got a podcast, and it's where I'm telling all my business and carefully commenting on other people's business, too. Now, it's respectable, but it's messy at the same time. So if you want to hear real stories and my real raw opinion on the ways of the world, listen to Carefully Reckless every Wednesday on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cavalry Audio.
As the summer of 1612 eclipsed in this wild new world, Adrian Block hastened a sunrise exit out of the Narrows before calling for a sharp left turn into the North Atlantic while the rising sun began to dissipate the early morning mists. Yet the two Algonquin brothers remained frozen, their deep brown eyes staring back at their homeland, even though its coastline had disappeared over the horizon an hour ago. And in the bright morning light, the teenagers did their best to intestinally reconcile the unnerving sensation of having nothing but a floating house between themselves and the swelling rolls of the great open sea when their captain, Adrian Block, was suddenly standing beside them, indicating in a modified sign language that they'd be much warmer below deck. And it was only then that the brothers first realized how bitterly cold it can suddenly turn out here in the open ocean. And so, as Block led them down the steep, narrow ladder that took them below the main deck, then toward the rear portion of the ship, to a tiny but pulsating kitchen, he called out to the single man inside this cramped, steaming chamber. "Good morning, Franz." And a wide, cheery face promptly appeared in the doorway. A big Dutch smile intended to disarm the tension blanketing these special guests. Diplomacy was a top-down methodology in Block's operation. And at only 24 years of age, cook Franz Janssen had already been around the world more than a few times as his culinary chief, and would prove to be a welcoming and calming presence to these radically displaced native sons. The minuscule space, barely bigger than a handicapped toilet stall, was by far the warmest place on this increasingly drafty ship. Block set the boys on a small bench across from Franz, who was already hard at work preparing the first dish intended to hearken them back to the only culture they'd ever known in their young lives. Those lives that had centered on the very patch of land that just happens to be the current location of the West 14th Street Apple Store today, a native settlement known for centuries as Sapokanakan, and an integral cultural center for the Algonquin people. And the dish that Franz was obsessing over? Steaming pumpkin squash, a vegetable they had known as well as any other in their short run on this earth, particularly as fall sets in. But of course, Franz and this worldly crew had traversed this planet enough to be well stocked with coveted additives, cinnamon and nutmeg among them, and a touch of allspice, just enough enhancement to make this momentous experience all the more wondrous to these youths from the wilderness of North America. Only a few years older than the brothers, Franz would soon endear himself to these wary chaps, his aromatic assertion and effusive amiability making him perfectly hospitable to these stoic, albeit frightened, beings from this new world. Confidently, Block left the boys with Franz, walked away, then paused to look back and consider. Though this was only his second voyage to this increasingly remarkable place, he was already returning home with hard evidence of his unprecedented progress into this potentially priceless market. Ah, yes. His visionary entrepreneur boss, Lambert van Twainhuysen, would be utterly speechless when presented with these budding Algonquins, Block accurately assured himself. All timber and wampum aside, this world-class Dutch captain was nearly guaranteeing Dutch control over this previously unclaimed market by delivering to his employer, along with a staggering trove of Castorgraaf furs, two invaluable emissaries from this wild and seemingly limitless alien land of opportunity. This is the podcast Island, the story of how this culture, this world, this island, the place we now know as New York, came to be. My name is Chance Kelly, and I look forward to you saying, wow, history is cool. Episode 8, Free Trade, 1613. Juan Rodriguez. All diplomatic prowess aside, nothing could have punctuated Adrian Block's granular examination of this native trade system any more precisely than this exercise of presenting two Algonquin guests to the awestruck powers that be in Amsterdam. And for that very reason, he was meticulously focused on their comfort during this momentous undertaking, and why he tasked the unflinchingly friendly Franz as his key liaison in that assignment. These brothers, they're similar, but different, Franz thought to himself as he winked at them cheerfully through his observation. One was slightly smaller, but far more tense. His hair was a shade darker, and he seemed to be less willing or able to relax in this strange environment, regardless of how nice Franz was being to them. But his brother, an inch or two taller and who stood a bit more upright in the presence of these strangers, had wider eyes and a more present disposition, a social alertness that seemed to hear and welcome the Dutchman's diplomatic efforts noticeably more than his shorter, tightly wound brother. No human had ever winked at them before, so the shorter one stared back at it guardedly, while his brother returned a hesitant grin while breathing in the steam that radiated from where Franz carefully scooped the fragrant, tenderized vegetable into a large pot of rich porridge, giving it an effective stir, then turning to those massive oysters roasting amidst the embers of his fire encased in a brick basin at his feet. Ah, those succulent shell delicacies, up to a foot in diameter, which the boys had themselves been pulling out of the upper bay of Manhattan their entire lives. And finally, Franz reached for the Turkish wheat, or what the boys knew as maize, which we would simply call corn, roasting inside its husks on the other side of his hearth, the veritable staple of these beings' very existence, not just nutritionally, but economically as well. And as the boys passed the time within this culinary clatter, the fragrant reminders of their lives worked as planned, easing their strained minds just enough as their newest comrade Franz stirred solemnly and smiled at them in between his lessons in Dutch. Beschout. And as his Algonquin students attempted to repeat the Dutch word for biscuit, not very well, Franz chuckled to himself and said, well, it's a good thing we have 10 weeks. And the taller one joined Franz in the laugh, as his vastly more cynical brother stared cautiously. And as Franz's mates periodically made their way to the kitchen for their rations of hardtack and brandy,
they shared information and ongoing commentary on the brothers. 19-year-old crewman Jakob Elkins took a particular interest in the boys. Something about them just connected for him. And his innate agility with language was not lost on them. And after meeting the boys, Jakob Elkins turned to Franz and he said, "You know, that story, Orson and Valentine?" And Franz chuckled again. "Yeah, you're right. I'd say this one is a lot more like Orson, and that one a lot more like Valentine." And Jakob Elkins, barely 2 years older than the brothers, stepped toward the shorter one. "You, mein vriend, Orson. And you, Valentine." And so the novel celebrity of these brothers was now fully established, and the Algonquin teens would enjoy that status amongst the crew of 15 Dutch sailors for the next several weeks. But as their customized provisions of squash, oysters, and maize began to expire, so did their novelty. So it would have been more than a welcoming sight when land was spotted after about 10 weeks on this increasingly unwelcoming floating house.
When the Dutch coast came into sight, the boys would have rejoiced. The end of their travails was in sight. Coming to anchor before Amsterdam, they will have marveled at the multitude of ships lying around, many of them much larger than the vessel they were on. They will have been in awe of the huge buildings built of brick, the roads made of stone, and throngs of people crowding the streets.
And these exotic strangers quickly became the talk of the town.
Absolutely. Very few Amsterdammers would ever have seen a Native American, and they will have crowded around them to take a peek. They were probably presented to the Amsterdam magistrates, lordly figures in their black cloaks.
The entire experience of which would be Manitou to these Algonquins, too wondrous to explain. And sure enough, Van Twainhuysen was nearly as enthusiastic about these living, breathing Algonquins as he was about the massive trove of pelts that Blok delivered to him. And Blok's men, always happy to rejoin terra firma, however briefly, each scuttled quickly back to their home turf before their next assignment. And by the time Franz Janssen made it 10 miles north to his port village of Monnikendam, the excited buzz of this vibrant new market and these Algonquin trade allies had beaten him to his town pub when he stepped in for a brandy with his hometown fellows. And it was then that he saw a face that he had never liked all that much. That of a narrow-eyed and narrow-minded local sea captain by the name of Thijs Volkerts Mosel. After working for a man like Adrian Blok, Franz knew all too well what types to steer clear of. And guys like Mosel were foremost among them. Franz sipped his brandy and did his damnedest to ignore him. But the shifty-eyed seaman beelined straight to him with a great sense of focus in his peering eyes.
Vierterhoog seaman.
Hello, Thijs.
Your father mentioned you'd gone sailing. West.
Yeah.
I heard a bit about it from Jacob Batanos and Baron Sweers. Sounds like quite a place, young man.
And Thijs Volkerts Mosel was just one of a swelling legion of souls to think so. In fact, those two friends that he mentioned, Baron Sweers and Jakob Batanos, just happened to be in the marine insurance business and just happened to have insured Blok's previous voyage. So the truth is, the route to the competition that developed after Blok's two momentous voyages to this new land was actually a duplicitous insurance agent. And so, among Adrian Blok's few faults, trusting people, and sometimes the wrong people, was definitely one of them. And fully aware of this competitive reality, visionary entrepreneur Lambert Van Twainhuysen was not going to waste another second, because he instructed Blok and Christensen to reassemble their crew only a few weeks after they had arrived in Amsterdam, as he would be sending them directly back to this vibrant and increasingly profitable island of Manhattan for a third time.
And so in staggeringly short order, Block and Christensen's ship, the Fortan, was suddenly sailing back to this bountiful wilderness once again. But in spite of the good intentions of Block and his allied Algonquin sachem awaiting the return of his sons across the Atlantic, the raw cultivation of early trade in this wild and untamed land traveled on a rather uneven course.
The thing that nobody anticipates, and that is the spread of epidemic disease.
Right. A pervasive and indiscriminate peril of this era was the frequent absence of immunities in the people who traveled from one continent to another. The first vaccination was still 2 centuries away at this point. So during Block's time, no one was immune to this danger. And what had started as a wondrous opportunity for these enterprising young native men soon turned into a nightmare. Not just for Orson, but for this entire community. When Valentine's young life ended, before ever returning home to tell his people about everything he had seen and learned in this wondrous place they call Amsterdam. And all diplomacy aside, the surviving brother would never quite come to terms with this loss. And in truth, one could say that Block and the Dutch never did either. Because one crucial Algonquin concept that the Dutch never seemed to be able to collectively wrap their hands around was the animism that these Native Americans knew existed in everything. And within this very mindset, the concept of social reciprocity is far more than just exchanging gifts and transactions in trade. As Professor Otto has explained, it means that they are connected now and forever.
You talk about in the book how there was initially a fascination of sorts. Like the Native Americans were awestruck by the Europeans initially.
Yeah.
There was a period where they were almost more compliant with them, perhaps, because of this fascination in this. It was so new. It was new and it was fresh, and they were intrigued by these visitors,
but perhaps even more intrigued by the concept of being truly connected to these beings who look, sound, and seem so different, who come in their great floating houses with their seemingly endless supply of metal and cloth goods that make the Algonquins' lives so much better and more spiritually secure. But as we've seen, that familiarity can breed contempt. Once the Algonquins really get to know these Europeans, there comes a sudden and marked change in the relationship, a shift in the dynamic.
The behavior of the Munsees started to change towards early settlers.
Yeah, I think that transition happens pretty quickly.
And it happens quickly, because the Algonquins are able to clearly identify how vastly different this new civilization seems to be from them, particularly in their mindset as it relates to this social reciprocity.
The importance of exchange between people, between individuals and animals. And so social exchange continues to guide Native people in the same way economic exchange guides the Dutch.
And the social exchange that Professor Otto is really talking about here is simply trust.
The exchange implied social cohesion.
And it would be the Europeans' inability to understand that particular mindset that would ignite the fuse to this eventual explosion. Even if Adrian Block and Jacob Elkins understood some of it, most of their people understood none of it. Of course, it is worth noting that Jacob Elkins had his own set of motivating factors, because Jacob Elkins was not like most other up-and-coming Dutchmen.
Charles Effenepoelze will be right back after the break.
G'day, we're Atlassian, the makers behind popular teamwork software like Jira, Trello, and Confluence. Whether it's real-time collaboration or staying aligned on key goals, Atlassian's agile work management solutions empower dev, business, and IT teams across the whole enterprise to work more efficiently together. It's exactly why 83% of the Fortune 500 trust Atlassian every day to stay agile and move work forward. See what Atlassian can do for your teams at atlassian.com.
Hear insightful, entertaining discussions on today's important health and wellness topics on the Health Discovered podcast from WebMD. Through in-depth conversations with experts, Health Discovered covers everything from tips for healthier living to the latest on therapy and mental health.
My goal is to really destigmatize mental health treatment and looking at it from a whole health perspective. Physical health and mental health can be intertwined.
Listen to WebMD Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Margaret Kiljoy. I'm a science fiction author, a feminist, an activist, and I'm the host of Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, a podcast from Cool Zone Media that tells you exactly what it's about right there in the title. It's easy to get overwhelmed by all the monstrous stuff happening everywhere, right? So it's important to hold on to the good. Me, I'm particularly interested in the rebels, the revolutionists, and all the people who fight back. So every week, I'm going to bring you a new story about those people, about all the amazing things that they got up to, so that we realize that we too can fight for the world to be better. Every Monday and Wednesday, I'll be joined by comedians, writers, journalists, and friends to talk through not just the stories, but what they mean for us today. Listen to Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The first of eight, Jakob was born out of wedlock before his parents actually got around to their marriage. And therefore, this fallen Catholic would not be able to inherit family capital like each of his other legitimate siblings would, which explains Jakob's commercial motivations. He had to be an independent man, an entrepreneur in many senses, in order to make his way. But also, for a far more deep-rooted reason, he needed to prove himself above and beyond his legitimate siblings or any such young adults coming of age around him. Jakob Elkins had far more to prove than any of them. And because of that, Jakob Elkins had an entrenched need and desire to connect with others. Jakob Elkins was different. He was a man without a real home, without a real family, in spite of his last name. And though he may have been a fallen Catholic, he was hardly a shallow soul. And Jakob Elkins was going to be somebody, one way or another. Yet the dark reality of the death of Valentine could be ignored by some, but not by Orson. And in spite of the ongoing vibrant trade that his own father and Adrian Block were at the center of, he was left asking, what was the meaning of this alliance? If only to seek profit. Yet where was the cohesion? And where was his brother? And it was this painful reality that Orson could never seem to get past. Regardless, by now, Block and his crew were engaged in brisk business with Orson's tribe. Block's third mission to this fruitful island, in 6 short weeks, he was on pace to surpass either of his previous 2 voyages. Now, as part of their business development, by now Block and Christensen had established a firm rate per beaver fur with the Algonquins, and in spite of the tragedy of Valentine, they were on their way to achieving great commercial and cultural harmony in this triangular trade region. But it would be during the 7th week of Block's tenancy in the Hudson, in the spring of 1613, that the harmony would end and the Unrust would begin. And it came when that very narrow-eyed sea captain, Thijs Volkerts Mosel, suddenly appeared in the Hudson River, captaining a square-sterned yacht called
the Jonge Tobias.
And as I mentioned earlier,
the crowd that Mosel ran with was not exactly the most pious bunch. And these guys just have a different style about them. His supercargo is a guy named Hans Joris Hontum.
Yeah.
Even his name.
Yeah.
Sounds bad.
Sinister. It almost has a sinister ring to it. Of course.
You kind of know it.
Yeah, Hontum, the Hontum family, I think were involved in the felting trade, the father.
Felting of furs.
Yeah, and in Rouen, France.
Okay. When we were speaking with Indira, I had mentioned that there was a process whereby the different types of beaver hairs were separated. Now, this specific process was known as felting. And one of the main purposes of this felting was that it produced a very effective waterproof quality. And this felting process would be applied to the manufacturing of any articles of clothing that really needed to be waterproof. And foremost among those articles would be hats.
Now, beaver felt is a textile, but it isn't woven. Instead, it is meshed, as beaver hair has barbs. So if you mesh it together tightly, it becomes very dense, but also versatile, wind-tight, and thus warm. So you first use a fur brush to shave off the short hairs closest to the skin. To bind the shaven hair together, they use the concoction with diluted mercury. Now, that is a poisonous substance when you inhale it. And that is where the expression, mad as a hatter, comes from.
And the hard truth is, there was probably a good amount of mad hatters running around Rouen, France at this time, as that was a major center for this felting trade.
You see more and more people in New Netherland turn up that have some sort of an association with Rouen. That's up in the northern France. And he's a bit of a disagreeable person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that truer words were never writ, nor spoken. Because, yes, Hans Joris Hontum was a bit of a disagreeable person.
You have to remember the period of time that they grew up in. They grew up in the 80 Years' War with Spain. A lot of military activity when they were young. So you have a group of men who have a very rough background. And Hontum had some issues with people.
Yep. Issues with people. A lot of issues with a lot of people. That's Hans Joris Hontum. And as supercargo of Mosel's ship, once Hontum learned the rate that Block had established with the Algonquins per fur, he immediately offered to pay the natives double. So, there's one issue he's going to have with Block and Christensen. Or more accurately, one issue they're definitely going to have with Hontum. But once again, Block being a businessman, a cerebral guy, a responsible captain with the safety and security of his men at the forefront, as well as his interest in maintaining a semblance of peace here among his Algonquin hosts, who have invested such vast trust and connection in Block by this point. The animism of his actions and the dynamic of this relationship is paramount to the Algonquins at this point. And Block knows it. And Block knows full well who these guys are, Mosel and Hontum. At least, he thinks he does. And he believes that he knows the level of trouble, or onrust, that they could bring. So like the true wartime consigliere that Block was, he cuts a deal with them. They'll share the fur trade. On this trip, anyway. Two-thirds to Block's party, and one-third to Mosel's. Not a great deal, but one that allows Block to profit some, return that profit to his investors, and not devastate his Algonquin hosts and allies. And most importantly, for Block and his men to live to fight another day. which Block and Christensen will do, you can be certain of that. Yet even in spite of this unprecedented diplomacy by Block, Hans-Joris Hontum's issues with people prevailed in the Hudson in the spring of 1613, particularly with the people whom he saw as vulnerable, like the Algonquins, and even certain of the men on his own crew. And the particular target of Hans-Joris Hontum's untoward ways aboard the Jonga Tobias was a young man who looked very different than the rest of this Dutch crew, and whose name sounded very different too. A man by the name of Juan Rodriguez. Because Juan Rodriguez didn't come from Amsterdam or from Monnikendam. He came from the Caribbean island that they were calling Santo Domingo, or La Española, but which we call the Dominican Republic today. All right, wait a minute. Dutchman on a Dutch yacht from Amsterdam by way of Monnikendam. How do we get a crew member suddenly from the Caribbean?
In these years, some of the skippers sailing to the Hudson River followed in the wake of Henry Hudson and took the Northern Way. This was a well-known route by this time. It was an extension of the cod fishery of Newfoundland. But there was also a southern route.
And now this southern route took them through what they were calling the West Indies, but which we simply call the Caribbean today.
Which was warmer and fitted in better with the prevailing currents. Mussel had sailed the first part of this route before. He had been to the Guyana coast first in 1598, and probably a number of times since. It is likely that he had also sailed in the Caribbean, either looking for a salt ban or engaging in smuggling. Hispaniola was a favorite place for some illegal trade, as it was isolated from the regular Spanish trade patterns.
And the mad irony of this overall story is never more alive than it is on the island of Santo Domingo in 1613, or La Española, as named by Columbus himself in his 1492 voyage. Because the funny thing about this Spanish one, or one of them, was that it really couldn't have been any less Spanish than it was by this point. Because the local population of this place was not Spanish, but largely African, brought here almost entirely by force by the Iberian partners of the Spanish, the Portuguese, who had an ingrained penchant for cultivating that vile trade for centuries. They were really the specialists when it came to trafficking humans in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Now, the other major portion of the local population was made up of the truly indigenous tribes of this island, mainly the Tainos and the Arawaks. These were the people whom Columbus would tag Indians back in 1492. Yes, because he thought he was in India. But as we all know well by now, he wasn't the only one thinking along those lines, was he? But in truth, these were simply the natives of the island that we now call the Dominican Republic. But yes, Columbus had called it La Española, or the Spanish one, because this was the very first of the Spanish colonies in this part of the world. Yet after a full century of failing to secrete the profit originally envisioned for this place by the Spaniards, they started to seek out their silver and gold elsewhere in the area, like in Mexico and Peru. And once they actually found it there, they really stopped paying any significant attention to the Spanish one any longer. Certainly not enough for its oppressed inhabitants to have nearly what they needed in order to move forth as a viable colony, the goods and resources necessary to survive within and run its own autonomous economy. You see, Spain was never really interested in colonizing from the ground up. Not the way the Dutch and the English were, anyway. Nothing like that. The Spanish were really only interested in taking over somewhat established cities, and only if they were
very rich in natural resources, particularly precious metals and other valuable commodities. So as a result of Spain's disinterest in really colonizing the Spanish one, this place had really devolved into this sort of forgotten welfare state of the Spanish colonial empire, but without the welfare payments from Spain. It had really degenerated into a bastard colony, and its people were left with absolutely no choice but to fend for themselves in order to survive.
We're not on the treasure fleet routes. We're not getting the supplies we need. The Dutch and the French and the English were all, as part of their orbit, were all supplying hides and so forth and essential commodities to people and smuggling. But there really wasn't that much the Spaniards could do. And the Portuguese also, and the Spanish monarchy system also, it's not really their business. So it's kind of a free-for-all.
Damas y Caballeros. Our next guest is not just a guy who knows a little bit about what the Spanish were up to at this time, but he also happens to be the co-author of The Worlds of the 17th Century Hudson Valley with our very own Menir Yap Yakup. So I'm extremely excited to introduce our very next historical excavator from the University of New Paltz, Professor Lou Roper.
So the Dutch are kind of on the ascendancy here. This is after the truce ends. And so the Iberians, I mean, it's impossible in the end for the Iberians to maintain the status they had. They had these huge territorial claims. They're colonists in places like Venezuela. They proclaimed they were being neglected. Santo Domingo, also, for that matter.
And so by the time a young man like Juan Rodriguez comes of age on La Española, the primary career path was that of a stevedore, which is a 17th century version of a Caribbean longshoreman. But on La Española, the stevedores also worked hand in hand with the extravagantes, more affectionately known as the Tango Mangos, who were the runners of this now well-established smuggling trade by the time Juan Rodriguez had come along. And the primary partner to these extravagantes in that game was, in fact, one of Spain's primary enemies, the Dutch.
The planters who grew tobacco and engaged in, they grew a little bit of cotton and things like that. Basically, they were smugglers. They invited Dutch, English, and French people, sailors, to come in, and they bring in goods, and they traded with them, again, because the Spaniards weren't providing the necessities of life. And then they're transshipping it to other colonies as well.
Never ceases to amaze me how crazy this story is, because it would be Spain's own focus on the silver market that would essentially cultivate the Spanish one into a thriving economy for its enemies in smuggling with the Dutch and the English primarily. A market driven on the demand side by the extravagantes, guys like Juan Rodriguez, and on the supply side by English and Dutch privateers.
Now hold that thought, because we'll be right back.
Tablo wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tablo wasn't who he said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season one is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tablo.
Hi, I'm Margaret Kiljoy. I'm a science fiction author, a feminist, an activist, and I'm the host of Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, a podcast from Cool Zone Media that tells you exactly what it's about right there in the title. It's easy to get overwhelmed by all the monstrous stuff happening everywhere, right? So it's important to hold on to the good. Me, I'm particularly interested in the rebels, the revolutionists, and all the people who fight back. So every week, I'm going to bring you a new story about those people, about all the amazing things that they got up to, so that we realize that we too can fight for the world to be better. Every Monday and Wednesday, I'll be joined by comedians, writers, journalists, and friends to talk through not just the stories, but what they mean for us today. Listen to Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you remember what year that was?
Oh, the year was 1986.
That's my mom talking about the year President Ronald Reagan signed IRCA, an immigration reform bill that will be considered radical today.
My mom loved Ronald Reagan. She prays for him all the time.
I'm Patty Rodriguez.
I'm Eric Galindo. Our new podcast, Out of the Shadows, Children of 86, explores how one stroke of a pen transformed millions of lives and this nation.
Like, if that never happened, like, I would not be doing what I do. You wouldn't be doing what you do. How many jobs have we created? How many millions of dollars of sales tax revenue for cities and for the state that we've created?
Join us for stories of people with hope and the ganas to dream.
I have the same rights as the president, the same rights. So nobody's going to stop me.
Listen to Out of the Shadows as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, why did guys like Juan Rodriguez want to get off that island so bad?
Well, it's not really a place where you're going to be able to make your way in the world. If you're not in this pretty small group of planters and really wealthy merchants who control this place.
Right, right.
And they have all these connections. They're fighting among themselves. If you're not in that group, you're up against it.
You're out.
And if you can get off, then you can get involved in this wider scheme. And again, people are coming by to take you other places. You can go to Amsterdam. You can go to New Netherlands. You can go to... It's pretty easy, actually.
So you see, Juan Rodriguez was not only familiar with merchant sailors, privateers, and at times pirates, but in fact, they were actually his livelihood. So Juan Rodriguez striking an agreement with a merchant sea captain like Dutchman Thijs Volkerts Mossel is simply the case of a demand side rep going to work for the supply side distributor. And now Juan Rodriguez didn't just bring trade experience with him when he left this island, because in addition to being an extravagante, Juan Rodriguez was also part of the local militia that would quite often rise up in rebellion against the Spanish colonizing leadership, the local governing body, such as it was. And this randy, ragtag, but increasingly effective militia of mostly La Española natives, partly or mostly of African descent, became well known as Los Mosqueteros because they were quite adept at loading and firing their muskets. So when a guy like Juan Rodriguez cuts a deal with a Dutch captain and climbs aboard his ship, a guy like Hans Joris Hontum would see him as somewhat vulnerable. But old Hans Joris Hontum is in for a bit of a surprise. And so in the 4 weeks it took the younger Tobias to sail from the Caribbean to Manhattan, Juan Rodriguez had had quite enough of Hans Joris Hontum.
He was a crew member on the ship of Thijs Mossel, and he indicated that he was very clear about the fact that he did not want to continue the voyage back to the Netherlands. So,
folks, I told you at the beginning that the story is complicated. And our resident expert on Juan Rodriguez himself is not actually Dominican. He's Dutch. Because, as you probably noticed in this story, this overall story, if you happen to know how to translate 17th century long script Dutch, you can be one of our historical excavators. Well, that's exactly what this next gentleman is able to do, and that's why he is our next historical excavator, Mr. Tom Vetterings, from his home base in Culemborg in the Netherlands. Welcome, Meneer.
Thank you. Yes.
You're very welcome.
Yes. He didn't want to go back with the rest of the ship to the Netherlands, so he jumped ship, literally. They gave him some supplies, 80 hatchets,
right,
a saber and a musket, as they said, in lieu of payment. So instead of him receiving his actual pay, which would have been pretty worthless in any case on the coast of New Netherland at that time, they gave him stuff that he could presumably trade or use to hunt or defend himself. And that was that.
And he would rather stay on Manhattan Island by himself, with only the natives, the native Algonquins, here with him, then get back on that ship and go back to the Netherlands with Theis Volkert's Mosul and this horrible Hans Joris Hontum, right?
Right. Yeah, it seems very clear that he regretted the his decision to get on board at that point. Yes, that's
right. And he was very happy to say, "No, I'll stay here. These Algonquins, they're very nice, and I'll set up here. Just give me some." So, and it was interesting. They didn't pay him in Dutch currency or gold or silver, guilders or anything else, because, as you said, what was he going to do with it? He's in the wilderness now, living amongst in the wild, but amongst the indigenous peoples who were the Algonquin natives. The only currency that's worth anything is something that they're willing to trade something else for. And so Theis Volkert's Mosul, the captain, pays him rightfully his wages, but in the form of 80 hatchets.
Yeah.
And so now he's got the goods to set up essentially a small trading post here.
And after Mosul and Hontum say good riddance to Juan Rodriguez, and Block and Christensen offer him passage to Amsterdam with them, which he also declines. So they sailed away too. And as I've already said, Juan Rodriguez was a hard, capable dude. And so in his own relentless effort to fight tyranny and escape oppression, Dominican Juan Rodriguez, in a fierce illustration of independence, defies and suppresses the oppressive forces all around him. And in doing so, inadvertently does something very, very special. Because the very first non-Algonquin resident of this incredible place was not an Italian sailing on behalf of the French, not an Englishman sailing on behalf of the Dutch, and it was not a rogue Walloon sailing on behalf of 12-year-old Queen Christina of Sweden. Because it was, in fact, a young man of African and Spanish descent who came from La Española, or the island that we call the Dominican Republic today, who settled in here in the fall of 1613. And suddenly, Juan Rodriguez had truly become a free man in every sense of the word, and had also become the preeminent emissary to Manhattan's developing free trade. And over the next several months, Juan Rodriguez would not only survive, but he, like Orson and Valentine, would learn a foreign culture, its language, and its trading system from the inside out, and progress this free trade forth in a way that no one had ever attempted before. And the harmony that Juan Rodriguez and his Algonquin hosts would enjoy that entire fall and winter would soon disappear in the cloud of unrest when these Dutchmen all return the next spring. And that's when things really heat up, which we can't wait to tell you all about in our very next episode. Dr. Charles T. Gehring and his New Netherland Institute in Albany have been instrumental not just in shepherding this project along, but in the cultivation of the entire study of this lost colony of New Netherland. Charlie, mein vriend, vedankt, meneer. Vedankt. Professor Paul Otto chairs the departments of History, Sociology, and Politics at George Fox University. His remarkable book, The Dutch Munsee Encounter, The Struggle for Sovereignty in the Hudson Valley, is available from most major booksellers. We enthusiastically thank Dr. Otto for coming on and providing his remarkable knowledge into this incredible era of this wild island of Manhattan. Vedankt. Dr. Lou Roper is a distinguished professor of early American studies at the University of New Paltz. His latest book, Advancing Empire, English Interests and Overseas Expansion, 1613 to 1688, from Cambridge University Press, is available at most major booksellers. Dr. Roper is credited as L.H. Roper on all his books. We greatly thank Dr. Roper for sharing his vast knowledge of this wider colonial world. Vedant. Mynheer Tom Vetterings wishes to thank and acknowledge the Dominican Studies Institute at the City University of New York, which was instrumental in his research into this fascinating story of Juan Rodriguez, the first immigrant to this incredible place. Vedant, Tom. Vedant. Island is an original production, researched, written, and produced by Chance Kelly and Dr. Yap Jacobs. Research Associate James Mallon. Executive Producer Alec Baldwin. For Cavalry Audio and iHeartRadio. Our 17th century Dutch musical arrangements are courtesy of Camerata Triactina. And I am your host, Chance Kelly, thanking you for boarding our voyage of discovery en route to saying, wow, history is cool. We'll see you next time.
Looking for a way to make quick cash? Making cash with DoorDash is super easy, guys. I love driving around my town, and now I can do that and get paid. Not to mention the sign-up process was so easy. Download the DoorDash Driver app today to get started.
Tableau wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tableau wasn't who he said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season one is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tableau.
Are you dealing with best life burnout, constantly striving for more, and quite frankly, over it? Maybe you just want more joy, peace, and laughter in your life now. Well, then let's go. Welcome to your new favorite podcast, Hot Happy Mess, hosted by me, your girl, Zuri Hall. We are celebrating our magic in the middle of life's messes. Don't miss new episodes every Wednesday. Listen to Zuri Hall's Hot Happy Mess on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.